try to make sure that we do justice to the lively aspects of the topic. You now have the privilege of making further comments on each other's papers. Is there somebody who wishes to start?
I'd like to start with just a brief comment let me just run up there, but I'm not going to be very long with this. I just want to make two comments about reason and autonomy. One is, I think that it's true that in Dr. Hayek's characterization of reason, there is a narrowness. It's the kind of post-Cartesian, post-Hobbesian notion of reason, where reason really is calculation, where it's basically modeled on mathematics. And if you wanted to stick with the philosophical underpinnings of libertarianism, with this form of rationalism, I think that you would be in trouble, and libertarianism would be in trouble. As a matter of fact, as I've indicated in my talk, there have been a great many developments in libertarian scholarship and philosophical investigations, and it's come to light that indeed the post-Cartesian model of reason does not give anything like the argument for libertarianism, but it does rightly give the Hobbesian argument for the Leviathan. And in fact, it is an Aristotelian view of reason, where reason includes things like opinion, because epistemically speaking, an opinion could be either good or bad or well-founded or totally capricious, and it can be rational opinion as opposed to be arbitrary opinion. So in this Aristotelian sense of reason, you can incorporate many of the things that Bill Kristol was worrying about as lacking in the libertarian ethos on the issue of politics, and have yourself a much broader conception of reason. And the only thing that conception is opposed to is force, not opposed to custom, not opposed to community, not opposed to habituation, not opposed to a lot of things. It's only opposed to the impossibility of reconsidering your opinion, because when you are forced to do something, you don't have any option to think things through once again. Now, that's one of my comments. The other thing is about autonomy. Now, look, I'm wearing a tie, I'm wearing a jacket, I'm wearing a belt, I'm being pretty conformist in this group, right? Look around you. Almost all the men are dressed fairly much like I am. Now, hardly anyone can claim that I am standing out here defending autonomy in the fashion of the 1968 hippies who wouldn't drive a cab unless they let them drive it with long hair and a beard, and then went to court to sue the company, to force the company to allow them to drive it. I mean, this is not the kind of autonomy that libertarians are talking about, and to sort of push us into that group is, again, just kind of saddens me to hear about it, because it means that this kind of distortion is necessary in order to cream our position. As a matter of fact, the only autonomy that the libertarian insists on is the autonomy of making moral judgment and at least having the opportunity of exercising moral judgment. In other words, there is a certain ancient tradition in which the notion of human dignity, of the moral nature of man, is emphasized, that I don't ignore it toward you and you don't ignore it toward me. Now, that doesn't mean we don't encourage each other. That doesn't mean we don't even urge each other on, egg each other on, we don't rebuke each other, ostracize each other, but there is a limit. There is, in some sense, yes, in some sense we are autonomous agents. We are responsible for our lives in the last analysis, but there's a lot that we can draw on: language, manners, morals, religion, science, and everything. And so, please, when the notion of autonomy is joined with libertarianism, I would like to ask those who want to come to terms with it to think about it in this term and not in the Hobbesian nominalist terms that we're all isolated monadic atoms, because from that nothing like libertarianism follows.
I want to change direction here a minute. We've been discussing some of the areas of difference. I'd like to have us take a look at an area of agreement where there's some unresolved problems. Last evening, we had an interesting event which posed a lively illustration of the dilemmas inherent in liberty. I confess the thought crossed my mind that our professional rascal Don Lipsett had staged it, but I don't think that was the case. But our distinguished lecturer had his freedom of speech blocked by another fellow who insisted on his own right to the freedom of speech. The situation in that instance was resolved only by the use of force. The audience discouragement didn't solve the problem. Now, how can that cherished dimension of liberty, the freedom of speech, which both conservatives and libertarians hold aloft as one of the highest principles, be safeguarded unless someone sets and enforces some rules which may interfere in the long run with somebody's freedom of speech? I'd be interested in both a libertarian and a conservative response.
Well, I think one of them should go first.
Joe, do you want to advocate a conservative solution to this?
It's a basic dilemma for anything.
Well, I don't think we really disagree about this one, do we? It's a matter of property right as well as the right of the audience to hear the speaker.
That would be the view of everybody.
I don't know. Bill, do you find yourself in a different position? I mean, this place has been rented by the Philadelphia Society. They have honestly obtained it from the proprietors, and this man assaulted us, and we have every right to protect ourselves.
Will you pass me my comments about you, Bill? A little point about Bill Evers' speech. He mentioned one of my intellectual heroes, Wilmore Kendall, is approving the execution of Socrates. I think Kendall didn't quite say that. In fact, I think he said something distinct enough that we ought to mark the distinction. He said that Athens was a good society, that Socrates forced the issue, and that Socrates agreed in principle with his executioners that bad teachers should be punished. So it was not a sort of libertarian case in that sense.
I just want to make about 3 points, but I guess I'm going to have to add something on Socrates. Considering Mr. Crystal's remarks, Erasmus once wrote a famous essay in praise of folly, and I think that in some ways we could retitle Mr. Crystal's remarks in a similar fashion. He wants to draw at least to our attention that opinion is an important element in political life, and I couldn't agree more with Mr. McCann that opinion can be good or bad, informed or uninformed, considered or ill-considered, and that we can handle that. And I think that the direction, though, that Mr. Crystal would like to take us, knowing that opinion figures in politics, is one of intellectual nihilism. That is to say, if he's going to pose, as strong as he does, some sort of unbridgeable gap between philosophy and society, I think he's going to get in big trouble. Because even this thesis that there is an unbridgeable gap is a thesis that it seems to me he has to have arrived at by consideration of reason and the evidence and so forth, and that this thesis of his requires application of reason and philosophy, and if he's going to say that it contains a truth about society that we have to be applying to society, then he's sort of got an internal problem there. I also would ask him, though, if he's going to reject Hayek's notion that we should consider institutions on their merits as to whether they are just and legitimate and so forth. If we're going to reject this, as he says, very stringent standard, and he wants to reject it in part because he thinks that the existing political institutions we have don't meet it, which I would agree. I would then ask him, and I guess I'm giving him a chance to fill in his closing remarks, what ought to be the overriding standard? If it ought not to be that the institutions are just, that they're legitimate, that they conform to right reason and natural right, what ought to be the overriding standard, the decisive standard, as to whether we accept their legitimacy? So, Mr. Crystal wanted to leave us with the notion that folly is part of human existence. In a sense, it's unavoidable, and in a sense, it may add some life to the whole matter. But I ask you, what should be done in this case? Should we maximize folly and the tremendous avenues for folly that a good-sized government offers? Or should we maximize reason, roll back the state, and leave room for moral development? I think that Mr. McCann did a good job of clearing up the problem of the use of the word autonomy and the social context in which we all live and grow up and interact. So I don't think I really need to dwell excessively on that aspect of Mr. Sobrin's remarks. But I thought I would raise one question. That is this. He says that somebody has to see to it that people are good. And he's not terribly enamored of the idea that the state be a gigantic busybody, an officious intermeddler of some sort that's omnipresently working on these things. But he says it's better that the state do these things and that nobody do them. Now, he seems, in his remarks, to somehow be drawing a difference between the virtuous and the good in a very sort of bizarre way. And what I think, if we examine what he said closely, we see that he's really saying that external behavior in many of these things, such as charity, religious worship, what books and magazines and so forth people read, external behavior is the good. Okay. I think that's a very, very unusual moral doctrine to just leave it at that. And I think, you know, he's stating a bold thesis, but I'm not sure I would call it conservative. So, as for Socrates, I think that Mr. Sobrin is correct in saying that Wilmore Kendall also sketches out Socrates' claim in the Crito that that to some extent the error of the Athenian assembly is not in accepting him as a good teacher. But what is important, and is my real point, is that Wilmore Kendall says that for the Athenians, questions about all sorts of values, and certainly we can see that Socrates raised questions on many and sundry subjects, questions of the sort that Socrates raised were closed questions. That is to say, questions that had been politically ruled out, discussion on them had been politically ruled out. And those who raised those questions, those who undermined the politically determined truth in these matters, not the rationally sought out truth, but the politically determined truth, ought to be condemned as Socrates is condemned. And therefore, I think that this line of thinking has to apply to Jesus too, if Wilmore Kendall's going to hold it.
Mr. Evers asks how we judge society at all if I deny that any society can be based on reason. I said in my remarks, this is by no means to suggest the abdication of reason from politics. Because all political societies are based on opinions does not mean some opinions are not truer or more praiseworthy or more conducive to human well-being than others. It does mean that one does not talk about maximizing reason. If one maximizes reason in politics, one has the rule of the philosopher king. The attempt by libertarians to somehow claim that their theoretical understanding is based on reason, and then to cut reason off, as Mr. Rothbard tried to do this morning, at politics, and then not have reason rule in the moral sphere, the aesthetic sphere, etc., is simply an assertion which I believe can't be consistently upheld. One point, I'm interested that all the libertarian speakers we've heard have appealed to various philosophers of the past, political philosophers, to support their position. Both Mr. Evers and Mr. Rothbard appealed to Locke. Locke, in his first letter on toleration, which is an argument, of course, for toleration, makes four exceptions. The fourth exception is that no society need or should tolerate atheists. Mr. McCann appeals to Aristotle to some version of Aristotle's metaphysics, with no mention that for Aristotle, moral virtues are habits, and with no mention at all of Aristotle's politics, which is not a libertarian tract. I think libertarians should have the courage of their convictions, which they usually do, and admit that no thoughtful man before 1750, I think is safe, was a libertarian thinker, and that if they want to argue that this is a new doctrine, which is true, which no one had known about for the previous 2,000 years of philosophy, and they want to derive it from Godwin or even 20th century libertarians, which I think would be more honest, they should do so. And I think the attempt to drag in Aristotle, Locke, at all does a disservice both to Aristotle and Locke, but also to original libertarian thinkers, because it is an original modern doctrine. One last point about Mr. Sobrin. Mr. Sobrin said, two points. Mr. Sobrin said that we have nothing to learn from liberals, which is somewhat true, though we might learn how to win elections. So as to perhaps slow down the decline of the West. But one last point, though, about libertarianism. It was interesting that Mr. Evers, in defending religious freedom, I think referred to said that every person owns his own mind. There's a right to own his own mind. I remember that Mr. Rothbard said that every person owns his own body. I wonder what the person is that owns both the mind and the body. And I suggest, and this isn't facetious, that more serious thought about the self, or the person, which allegedly owns its own mind and its own body, would be helpful for libertarians.